Welcome to the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast. Hi, I'm David Mantian. Welcome to a new episode of the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast. With me this week is Robert Beasley, CEO of Fluent. Thank you very much for joining me today, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach me at david@cannabisequipmentnews.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter and make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. Robert, it looks like you have a very rich history with the cannabis industry, and I always like to start learning a little bit about how you came to the industry. So what was it that brought you to cannabis?
My practice was commercial law as well as commercial real estate development, and I had worked in doing condo projects and real estate projects throughout Florida. That got me involved in legislative initiatives to some degree. In that process, I started tracking and worked with the groups that worked on the constitutional amendment originally. I became involved in that part of the process, then subsequently the legislative process, and then the regulatory process, then represented applicants in Florida in the first round. When those applicants were successful, I became kind of an advisor to three of the five that received the original award of licensure. Pretty quickly, that moved me into being the on the board and then director of the board for one of the original five. And so I helped that company build out, go through the licensing steps, the checkoff steps towards production. We were able to get one store open, and then we rolled that company to Afria early on, which is now Liberty in Florida. And so that got me started. And then from there, I became a consultant. And my work then was to go around and for companies that had caught the bus and had received an application, a license, standing up the company. Turning the license into an operating company. And I did that in multiple states. I was then asked to come back to Florida to Fluent as an advisor in January of 20, with the idea being that the company wasn't as healthy as the board would like it to have been, but they just didn't really know how to fix it. And so then I was engaged to get involved and take the lid off of a bunch of boxes and start turning knobs and levers to turn the company around, which through a lot of good luck and hard work, we were able to do.
What was it like on the early days on the legislative side of things? What was it like trying to navigate that environment?
Well, going into the constitutional amendment effort in Florida, the politics were right. The supporter was a lawyer in Florida named John Morgan, who was very, very strong politically, very well known for putting his own personal money where his mouth was. I think he put $7 or $8 million of his own money into the constitutional effort. He was very well aligned with the then actors in the government. But at the same time, the reason constitutional amendment was required was there was no legislative appetite to take the risk. There was not, you know, back in 15, 16, you know, you just didn't have the, in a southern state, you just didn't have the political risk stomach to step out there and get the votes. And so we were not going to get the votes. It had to come through a constitutional amendment. You see that very similarly now in many southern states. You know, there's just too many winds against it, even now.
So when you joined Fluent in 2020, I read that you resurrected the company from, quote, imminent collapse. What was going on?
You know, it's easy to blame Fluent's then management, and truly they had done a very poor job of stewardship for the company. But really, they had done no differently than following the green rush at that time. The best way to say it was the company was, I like to say it was 100 miles wide and 1 inch deep. It had the energy of the green rush was, you know, secure a license in Florida, great. Go secure one in Texas, great. Secure one in Pennsylvania, secure one in Michigan, secure one in Puerto Rico. The problem is that as you secure these licenses, these are wins, but a license now especially, but even then, were just an invitation to spend an awful lot of capital, risk capital, to invest vertically. And so this company had developed horizontally very strong, but it didn't have the assets and it didn't have any revenue to develop those assets in a vertical way. So I had to actually grow by contraction. So what I did was, coming in with a fresh look, took a lot of the projects, rabbit trails, dead ends, And with a fresh look and without the fear of being, as they say in poker, pot committed, I started cutting things. I started cutting off assets that did not look like they would produce revenue or did not produce revenue in a short enough time to matter for this company. And, you know, we cut off Puerto Rico. We cut off several international operations that were all just kind of a little bit of a dream that maybe realized one day, but not in enough time to save Fluent. Recognizing that what they had going was Florida. They had 20 stores at the time, but they didn't have enough production. The company was very out of balance. In a vertical operation, balance is key. Balance and scale. Scaling in balance is the trick. And this, there was just no recognition of what needed to happen. And so we were able to get production up and then manufacturing up and then shore up the ability of inventory to, for the stores to have good, robust inventory. And then from there, sales followed. Pennsylvania is a great example of what was going on. The company had secured a license for three stores in the South Central region, but it only had one store open. And so pretty easy game plan. Get two more stores open. Maximize your result and your return off of the assets you've already secured, the license you've already secured, and stop looking over the fence at getting the next license for a minute. And so we grew by contraction. Now we're a strong, solid company. We, our footprint is not as large as it once was, but our balance sheet looks a whole lot better. We were, the company was insolvent, in by any definition of the word as of January of 20. And now it's a robust, taxes are paid, which is a very rare thing for a cannabis company. We don't have a receivable past 60 days. It's not disputed. Everybody's wages are, we've raised the wages up throughout the company. So we're in a great, healthy position right now.
How close was the company to closing the doors?
In Florida, they were running out of inventory in the stores by 11 a.m. And unable to service the customers from 11 a.m. to close at 8 p.m. They just didn't have the production. The debt was due. It was an early first stage cannabis lender who was what we like to now call loan to own. And there was going to be no quarter given of that. So we had it was kind of like Men in Black for a year. We saved the universe of Fluent every day, it seemed. And close, I'd say close was the status that we lived in for a year. And then it got better. Some of the efforts we took place, you know, it, these plants are tricky because it takes, you know, 14, 16 weeks for them to do anything for you once you plant the seed or the clone in this case. And facilities are even more tricky. We had to build a facility. And so that took 10 months. And so we were a year baked in of you know, hope and promise before we started realizing it. But once it caught, after we had caught out the millions and millions of dollars of dead ends, then that revenue started coming in and it started filling the coffers and allowed us to grow.
I want to talk about that ramp up a little bit more. How did you fix these supply chain issues and ramp up production? You know, did you establish new grow facilities? Did you just increase your current footprint? How did it work?
So the company, upon my arrival, was leasing a greenhouse facility in Winter Garden, Florida, that was just not a, it's not a suitable facility for cannabis. It was an old hydroponic facility of some other type of plant growing. And the practices and farming practices of the company were not adequate for that type of environment. It also had another indoor facility that was this monstrosity, six levels, and they just weren't maximizing it. They were getting about 80,000 grams harvest a month out of that facility. That same facility produces 1.3 million grams a month now. So you could see the difference in the same exact footprint and just putting in farming practices that match the environment. And that's the key. It's, you know, there's all kind of growers out there now, but a real grower can come into the environment they're in and develop farming practices and cultivation practices that match that environment, because this plant is, it's very durable. It'll allow you to do a lot of influencing of its growth cycle. And so you can manipulate this plant to fit most environments. If you can't, then, you know, trying to bring the environment to the plant is a very expensive option. Mm-hmm. So we increased cultivation output, and then we did immediately could start constructing an indoor facility, which came online. And what we did was we brought it online one set of three rooms at a time. So we needed to, we built the airplane while flying. So we started growing in three rooms out of 11, and then we added 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 over the course of about a 10-month period.
So you've overseen the design and construction of five cannabis cultivation and processing facilities in the past. You know, what sort of best practices did you bring when it came to scaling production? And did you also have to, you know, was there any turnover? Did you have to kind of bring in people with a similar mindset when it came to what you think is best practices when it comes to cultivation?
There was a great deal of turnover. And there were also, a great deal of readjustment of, you know, when you had a company that was kind of in a desperate state, people were all working outside of their skill level. And so you had to, you know, start putting people kind of back in their right place, if you would, and then supplementing the bench. And so bringing on high quality, expensive talent is tricky. And so I had to build the bench, you know, one piece of talent at a time. But so there was pushback from that. The trick though is, you know, start low and go slow, right? That's one of the cannabis mottos. It applies to production as well. You know, these companies that build these massive facilities and then try to, you know, make the need or the demand meet the facility, you know, it's really kind of a difficult proposition because you end up with so much capital investment. Whereas if you could take a more segmented and more deliberate type triage approach where you build two grow rooms and then three and then seven and then 10, if you can design your facility to where it's segmented in that way, then you're better off because it takes a while for this product to be absorbed either through your own retail shelf or through the wholesale. And so, you know, it's just not a build it and they will come philosophy. You just have to let the market absorb your product.
Did you have to invest in new equipment?
Some, you know, in the early days, you know, we're borrowing equipment and techniques from other industries. You know, the great thing about being around now, I guess, as a veteran in the industry is watching other technology industries come to cannabis. You know, just go into MJ Biz, the floor in Vegas. If you've been there year after year, you go from, you know, one trimming machine to 5 to 7 to 20. You know, you go, you know, the amount of technology that's come into the industry has been exponential in the last 3 to 5 years. And so in the early days, we were using other agricultural techniques and machinery to then modify it. I mean, our first operation, I did a hemp and cannabis operation in Oregon. We had 700 acres of hemp without any idea of how to harvest it in a safe manner. And so back then it was just really just good old fashioned farming ingenuity. And now there's equipment out there that is specifically designed for any specific purpose, but it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And so what you have to do is you have to do the FTE versus technology investment measurement, which is, you know, am I hand trimming? Okay. Well, hand trimming is an output derived type analysis, but it involves labor. You know, now I go to a machine trimmer. Well, a machine trimmer will cost me $50,000 for a good Mobius. $50,000 relieves this many FTEs. And do I have the volume? Am I scaling correctly to then take that next step of automation? Scale is the killer in cannabis because you have to go from nothing to something and you have to match your consumption on the other side. And so each scalable step, there's usually an automated piece of equipment now at this point that allows you to automate if it works for you on scale. The worst thing is to have $1 million piece of equipment that you run twice a month because you're just overstepped on that automation step, whereas you really should have had 3 employees handling that step and use that $1 million for something else that could be automated. So where to automate as you scale is the critical decision making. And it's somewhat just math. I mean, at some point, if you know yourself, you've got to learn yourself. You've got to learn your cogs. You got to learn, you know, what it takes you to produce a milligram, what it takes you to process. And once you learn yourself, then you could start, you know, comparing a capital investment versus an ongoing labor expense.
Mm-hmm. What are FTEs? Are those field tech?
Those are employee hours. The amount of hours, an employee unit of hours. And so versus number of employees, because an employee could work various shifts. We have night shifts and day shifts or whatever. And so we break it down into the number of employment hours that would go into a task.
Okay.
So like if you trim you know, a pallet, you know exactly how many FTEs go into trimming a pallet, how long 4 employees should take to trim one pallet, so forth, so on. And you start dicing it like that, then you can evaluate whether your trimming practice is the most efficient.
You're right about the innovation and the new equipment coming to the industry. What is your methodology when it comes to, are you an early adopter or are you more wait and see with new tech before you bring it in-house?
We're a wait and see. We have not been able to take the risk on a new opportunity or new technology that is a proposed opportunity. If it's not proven out, we can't afford to make the mistake. We're not that big. Even our progress resulted in fairly good sized closet full of equipment that didn't work out. I've got a laser etcher right now that we got in from China. We waited 6 months on. Doesn't work like we thought it would. And so waiting and seeing on the bigger investments is the right answer for us because we can't take the chance.
We hear about that all the time. For lack of a better term, like the dusty equipment in the corner. Once you realize a piece of equipment is not working, what do you do in terms of trying to either resell it or do you kind of hold out hope that it might have a right fit in the future?
Unfortunately, we move very, very fast. The technological year in cannabis is very short. It's probably 3 months, 4 months. And so a lot of our equipment that's in place working, there is a bigger, better version of already today. But we haven't set up a program for intended reuse, because if it doesn't work for us today, it is usually just yard sale material at that point, regardless of what we paid for it, because its technology, the version of it, whatever it is, the piece of equipment, the technology version 1.0, 2.0 that it represents that doesn't work for us is not going to get better. What's going to happen is there's going to be a 3.0 or a 4.0 of that same piece of equipment. And so putting it on the shelf to use later, the technology movement growth passes it by too quickly, very quickly. It would be like putting your 8-track cassette player on the shelf, saying, I'm going to use it in a couple of years. Well, next thing you know, it's not even a piece of technology that could be incorporated into anything.
I don't know. The 8-track in our basement's still working, and it's a heck of a thing to pull out at a party.
Yeah, that's right. It's a novelty. But you wouldn't have as much fun pulling an old trimmer out.
No. I wanted to go back to some of those rabbit trails and dead ends that you were talking about before, because they are extensive. You closed a grow in Michigan. It was, quote, a train wreck in Puerto Rico. You closed operations in Colombia, Brazil, Australia. I mean, was that sort of just one swoop to kind of tighten things up as you were growing by contraction? Or, how did you determine that some of these projects needed to go by the wayside?
So one, the benefit of a fresh look, we were spending more than we were making. So you start there and you start with a number. How much more are we spending than we're making? Now that's our objective. All right. Where do we accomplish those savings? And I did other things. I took the guns out of our security guards in every store, $1 million savings. I didn't want to shoot out in our stores anyway. And so it was easy $1 million to save. So it wasn't just closing off operations, but the operations usually represented the biggest bang for a buck as far as what we could do. So we started with what our objective was. And then there were some that were easy. You analyze the market, you analyze what we had in, the trick is objectivity, because these weren't my babies. I didn't spend the time, effort, and live. These weren't my dream. This was somebody else's dream, and that dream had already failed. And so it was easy to come in and sit in judgment of objectivity over someone else's failed ideas, because they had already proven out to be failures, or if not failures, failures within the lifespan of recovery of the company. Some of the ideas are probably excellent ideas. The Brazil opportunity is going to be a winner one day. But, there's a long winter before that one day, and we don't survive it. So a lot of them were easy. The hard one was Michigan. So Michigan was on the bubble for me. I was on the cutting room table, and I saved it. I saved it for one reason. At the time I looked at it, Michigan has a license renewal opportunity every year. So we had already paid $500,000 to renew for that year. So we were in. We had a crop in the ground, said, let's give it 1 year. We gave it a year and we harvested a mediocre crop because the crop that was in the ground wasn't starting, started too late, to be honest with you. And the market was very volatile. We had a mediocre crop. It was an outdoor crop. We have a zero mold standard in Michigan, but we had an outdoor crop, so we had to do some remediation. By the time we got it to market, the product was a little bit older. We had missed the window and the values had gone down. So there were five or six outlying reasons that I could point to as to why we were not successful that year in Michigan. And so the data, the decision was unclear. So I did it one more year. I got in the ground on time. I put a real crew on the ground up there that knew how to do it. We produced and harvested a beautiful outdoor crop. We had our post-harvest handling already in place, whereas before we had to do it on the fly. We had our treatments and mold to get the past the mold standards in place. We had buyers lined up the best we could. We did everything right, and it still was not successful. And then I eliminated all of those casualty events, all of those things we did wrong the first time, and then could see clearly the analysis and said, okay, why were we not successful now? This was my doing. This wasn't someone else's doing I inherited. This was done right. You know, we're pulling 25, 26% THC values, beautiful crop, but it's still an outdoor crop. That allowed you to look at other outside of your control forces. In this case, there's the lack of enforcement of illegal product that was going on in Michigan, causing severe volatility in pricing. And that's nothing I can control. I can't make Michigan's regulators do their job. I'm not big enough. I'm not strong enough. And so now I realize I could do everything right and not be successful. Time to pull out. And so I pulled the plug. When I pulled that plug, you know, there was, you know, it wasn't an easy decision, but it felt like the right decision. Turns out to be an excellent decision because the market continued to slide and we would have just done nothing but continue to lose money. So then all of my successes in Florida, all of my successes in Pennsylvania, everything I had going would have just been drawn into Michigan, into this giant black hole. And that is what you have to avoid.
Do you have a stronger draw towards medical only states because there's more control over the supply chain and regulation?
Currently, yes. This company needed to be in a controlled environment so that it could reborn, you know, rebirth itself and come out of the ashes. And you can do so safer in a controlled environment. Plus, it just was blind luck. We were already in Florida. We had Florida. Florida was our biggest going concern. Florida was the best place to grow, and it was a medical environment. Verticals are harder to operate than non-verticals. And so because of that, you can do more good in a company that's got vertical operations because there's more opportunities for efficiencies. And so cleaning up Florida was mission critical, number one. In doing so, realizing the growth in Florida allowed this company to upright itself. Currently, we are now solid enough that we could be competitive in an adult use market. Which is a little bit faster, a little bit higher volume, and a little bit more volatile in pricing and competitive. We're not afraid of such a market today, but it was not the right place for us in the years prior.
What was the train wreck in Puerto Rico?
The facility was sited in the wrong location. Politics are always kind of odd in Puerto Rico. We had a bad partner, and we had a hurricane. And so you had a facility that was almost operational. Hurricane hit it. You had a lot of, everyone seems to have their hands out down in Puerto Rico. And so you had a lot of struggles that were outside of market struggles. And then ultimately you had a very small serviceable market. Why even be in Puerto Rico if you're in Florida and not serving Florida correctly? You know, Puerto Rico's standing population is not even Orlando. And so, you know, it just was not a hard choice. No, don't spend $3 in the smaller market. Spend those $3 in your bigger market and you get a $6 return. Puerto Rico had a very long return on investment. And then we had that setback with the hurricane. And so it just, nothing was right about the opportunity there. And it was time to walk away.
Okay. So how did you sort of pull the company out of chasing that green rush? Was it just like, I mean, it sounds like it was just down to that equation that you have.
it was just down to that equation. It was, you know, we're spending more than we're making. We can't afford to get out in the field. You know, and that's been our struggle with Texas. You know, Texas, we've had that license for some time, tremendous value for this company. But we, quite frankly, the market conditions in Texas did not allow us to spend our precious capital to try to develop it until now. Now, all of a sudden, Texas is coming online. We have more extra dollars, if that makes sense. There are no such things, but we do have enough dollars to start supporting what somewhat of a building speculative effort in Texas, which has a very long slope towards return on investment. But before, I needed that dollar in to result in $3 out in a very quick turnaround, and it wasn't Texas. Same thing with the new licensed state. We are now venturing into other licensed states. We have an application pending in Alabama. We're probably 20 days, 30 days from knowing whether that's successful. We're looking at partnerships in other states. We are ready to grow now, and we're able to withstand some risk. Whereas before, we were so fragile that those risky ventures of stepping out, you know, the only worse than not getting a license in one of these states is getting one within very tight timelines of performance. Look at what's happening in New Jersey. It's a race. And the problem is that the losers are going to have spent just as much as the winners, and they have no go forward model. And so, you know, if you get in that race and the prize is a ticket, well, that ticket is an opportunity to spend money. You know, that's a pretty dangerous funnel to get into if you don't have the ability to withstand the to support the capital needs once you win.
What are you looking for in partners in other states?
We're looking for compatible footprints. You know, we're in Florida, Texas, and Pennsylvania. The Northeast is strong. The Midwest is strong. Missouri is very strong. We're looking for compatible footprints. We're looking for operators who have caught the bus and are realizing that this is hard and that we really need someone to, you know, be a better operator and maybe an operator partner. You know, we don't have a lot of money to offer, but we do have a lot of skills. We're looking for someone who's an operator with a compatible small footprint that needs help, but isn't so debt laden that we have to take on their debt to get them out of their decisions. You know, we've uprighted, we've made it above surface, but we're just on the surface, and we're just not strong enough to make up for someone else's bad decisions. You know, we're in capitalistic society, and bad decisions of management should lead to failures in some cases because that's how it works. And so we've looked at deals, and I've passed on a lot of deals because they took themselves in too deep. But there are plenty of operators out there that didn't make all of those mistakes. They just made some minor ones, and they have a lot of growth potential. They really need help. They need a partner that can create a synergy of operations and so forth. And that's who we're looking for. And they're out there. We've talked to quite a few. They're usually smaller groups. They're usually what I'd call mom and pop operations that have done all they can do to get to where they are. And now they've reached kind of the apex of their ability to make more improvements. And they need to scale. And when they're ready to scale, we look down to them in scale and say, let us help you get to here. And take those scaling steps efficiently now and not take all the wrong steps that we took and others have taken.
Are those mom and pops open to that, or are many of them happy with how big they are?
So it depends on what the market's telling them. In Pennsylvania, there were several mom and pop grow operations that we really wanted a relationship with, but wholesale was red hot a few years ago. They thought the money was just going to keep raining, and they weren't open without a really big price tag. They've all come back now because that wholesale market dried up, which was predictable. If you just watched the rate at which the MSOs were building their own facilities, you saw it coming if you were paying attention. Now they've come back to us, but now they're overbuilt. And, you know, the glory days of selling that big number is gone. And so there needs to be this compression of value impression. So, you know, they have to get it out of their heads what they could have sold it for 2 years ago and get down to, you missed it. You just missed the window. So once you get right with that idea in your head, let's work together to work towards the next window, because what they were doing was successful. It is very easy to be successful and as a first mover in a cannabis state for a very limited period of time. And you start drinking your own Kool-Aid at some point and forget about the fact that you're going to have to get more efficient. You're going to have to be more competitive. You're going to have to scale. What you're doing now isn't going to make you successful in 3 years because you're a first mover. And that disillusionment hits people about year 3 to 5.
Why do you grow using clones?
Time and genetic reliability. There's a variance in genetic outcome in seeds that's acceptable. And then there's a variance within clones that's acceptable. And the percentages of the difference between those is dramatic. Then plus you pick up the time of the difference between a seed to 3-inch start from a 3-inch start. So time and genetic reliability are the two reasons.
We talked about equipment.
Tissue culture, by the way, is the next step to that. Tissue culture. So you have seeds. You asked me about seeds and clones, and that is a great comparison. But the more modern comparison, the more current comparison is clones to tissue culture. And tissue culture gives you even more genetic reliability of redundancy. It also allows you to wash out some of the virus issues you have with the hop-laden virus and so forth. And it also gives you a jump on that time and ability to preserve your genetics. So as you move through scalability, if you can afford it, ultimately getting to a tissue culture model is your most efficient model.
How far away are you from moving to a tissue culture model?
We have tissue culture going for preservation. It's an absolute winner for preservation of your genetics. Instead of having a giant mom room that you got to heat and cool and keep those babies alive, mom's alive, quite literally, they're in a petri dish frozen. So it's the right answer for, the first step is genetic preservation. The next step is production. We are not yet in the production step.
You just opened your 30th store in Florida. You know, what are your, what's that? Oh, 31? 31. Oh, sorry. Sorry, my numbers are off again. What are your future plans for Florida?
We have four more stores in process. We will open a store a month pretty much for the rest of the year. We have Crestview, Florida opening next, and then Jacksonville, Cassatt opening next, and then Cocoa Beach. Going back to balance, our production output puts us at about 35, 36 stores to stay in balance. So it's time for me to start working on increasing production in Florida. We need to take some step. I have three or four projects going right now. Not sure which one's the right answer, but we need to take an efficient step towards increasing production. Think about a vertical operation as three or maybe four companies in one. You have a cultivation company, you have a manufacturing company. You could also say you have a logistics, shipping, and packaging company, and then you have a retail company. And those are three separate silos. Maybe four. I like to think about them as the knobs on an equalizer, and they have to be in balance. You know, when I first started, I get this question. I still get it, which is, how many stores do you have? And I always answer, I'll tell you that number, but I'm a vertical operator. What you really need to ask me is, what is my production ratio to my shelf ratio? Because I'm not the gap. I have to grow it to sell it. And so the number of doors, which is a traditional way of looking at the economic viability or health or evaluating a company, really doesn't apply. I could have 50 stores and only enough feed to feed 20. And you're going to see that in the cost of goods sold and also the revenue to expense ratio.
Are you a musician? Only because the example of the equalizer...
No, I just used to own an old hi-fi system.
Okay.
And I remember the dials. And that's the best way I can describe what you have to do is you can't get out of balance.
Is there enough opportunity still in Florida to grow in balance and be very lucrative without sort of getting riskier growing in other markets?
A little bit. We have one more growth step to make in Florida, and then we need to hold tight because of the increasing competition in Florida. Florida is a little bit open with respect to there's no store limit. There's no cultivation size limit. There's none of the traditional limits in other states that would keep a company from the biggest, most capitalized company wins, right? So it's a matter of throwing money at it. The flip side of that is, So you have all of these competitors coming in with big pocketbooks, and they're putting a lot of stores on the ground. I know one company that came in overnight. They've got 25 stores under construction. the flip side is that we only have 880,000 customers in Florida. That's it. It's a medical state. You know how many customers you have. They're all registered. And so as your competition grows, as everyone grows their footprint, as everybody grows their number of stores, and you have the same customer base, then it's all about market share. And we're really good at taking market share. But, you know, cannabis customers do get influenced by new. They get influenced by sales, and price pressure is on. And so there's a little bit more growth for us in Florida, but there is probably no more growth like we have seen unless and until we go to adult use or reciprocity is allowed. We need some legislative movement to allow the market to go from the 880,000 customers that are potential to the 21 million potential customers that is the Florida population, which then extends into the 80 million potential visitors every year, 59 million of which come to see the Mouse in Orlando. And so, you know, let me go from 800,000 to 21 million as potential customer base, and now I can think about growing again. But I'm almost grown up to where I need to be in Florida in its current regulatory environment.
How far is Florida? Oh,
the thing is, I would hate to be one of these new 22 applicants. 22 applicants are on the market. Who knows when those licenses will be issued? The Department of Health, for various political reasons, is very slow in their movement. And I don't know when those licenses will come out, if ever. But if they did, 22 more competitors in Florida with the $40, $50, $60 million capital obligation coming into this market with the market shares already allocated, it would be a scary proposition.
How far is Florida from being adult use?
There's a movement now, which has been well supported. The people want it. I mean, to get the signatures needed for constitutional amendment is not easy. It has cost a lot of money, but it's doable. It goes back to the politics. You know, the attorney general, who is part of the executive, has already weighed in that to the Supreme Court that she does not believe that the current petition is going to pass constitutional muster. The Supreme Court has been very reluctant to certify any initiative since the change of the standards. And so I think that it is a very narrow chance that it gets done. We have a governor that is just announced today that he's running for president. So far, which, you know, we all knew for the last year or two, but so far, his support of the program has been, I'd say, neutral. I think he has all the cannabis program he wants in Florida. And I don't think expansion is within, you know, is supportive of his agenda. And so I think you probably sit like we are for a while. I keep hearing dates, and I keep hearing probabilities. I couldn't tell you that I support the high probability of it going adult use in the next year or two.
Do you get involved on the legislative side anymore?
I don't. I've had a lot of work to do, and we needed to exist as a viable going concern and as a strong competitor in Florida. We've gone from number 14 to number 6 in Florida. It took a lot of work to get there, and what's happening in the politics, I haven't seen an issue that is yet important enough to us, individually us, not us as an industry, for us to spend the time, effort, and money. Because every single dollar we have needs to go buy a new trimmer or open a new store or something along those lines. We do not have the money for politics right now in our budget.
Are you sleeping easier than when you first came on board 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
A little bit. You know, the proposition that I was handed was, you know, this is nose down, about to hit the trees. See if you can pull it up. And there was a little bit of freedom in that because it was fairly bad off and I almost couldn't do wrong at first. But so at first it was a little bit carefree. There was so much low hanging fruit. I didn't realize I had acquired the industry knowledge, not just in the finance and the legal side, but in the actual operation side. I know, hanging around and being involved in operations and making operational decisions for years had really put me in a much more educated position than I even realized. And so I could see it. I could see how easy these changes were. And so the low-hanging fruit was so available that it was easy, if not fun, and easy to look good, because you could make these changes. Where I started losing sleep was when it started to catch and we had momentum, because now we had something to lose. And then the decisions got a little trickier. The low-hanging fruit was gone. Even today, we're in the finite polishings of some of the efforts that we're in. And now the decisions are a little more cloudy. And the consequences are that we could lose ground and market. The consequences are that we could not meet our revenue goals. Markets are pretty unforgiving. I mean, look at our stock. If you go back and look at quarter over quarter, year over year, the growth that we have put up, the numbers we have put up, you know, 40% growth, 80% growth one quarter. I mean, it's been phenomenal. If we were any other stock on the market, people would be piling in. But we're throwing up these numbers, meeting our revenue goals, growing faster than most any entity that you've seen, and our stock goes down the whole time. Or when it goes down or up, it has no relationship to our economic performance. And so when it started to matter, I started losing sleep. In the early days, it was do what you can do, pick all the low-hanging fruit, and see what happens.
From the operational side, have you had any issues finding talent in Florida? And have you found any opportunities to bring automation into your facilities?
We early days, there was a lot of issues finding talent. In the last year, there is a flight of talent from the West Coast. Those markets doing so poorly. If we put the word out, not even an ad, we will get several qualified resumes that want to come east. And so now finding talent is a lot easier. But in the early days, talent was very difficult to find. You know, you had a lot of people that had done it one way, and their resume consisted of one facility, 3 years of experience. And that's all they knew. And so it was hard to get them to translate. Automation, we talked about earlier. In the early days, automation was really just using other industry automation and incorporating it. And it was what I call farm engineering. You know, no one's more industrious or more mechanically inclined than a farmer. You go to any farm, you'll see something welded to something else, and they've got a tractor with the wheel off pulling a band. You know, that's what it looked like in the early days. We were in Connex boxes. We were welding Connex boxes together. You know, we were just cobbling it. Now there's less cobbling because the industry, the technology has invested themselves in R&D, and they're bringing us products that meet our need. Whereas before, we were creating products that met our need.
Do you plan on focusing on the U.S. Specifically, or are you looking at any international markets?
Given our history as a company, you know, international endeavors is kind of a bad word. You know, we spent a lot of money in countries that, you know, didn't result in any kind of revenue. I think that where I would more likely focus than internationally is the Southeast, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama. You know, it's still the last frontier, you know, and logistics are easier. I don't have to go to Europe. I can go to North Carolina and South Carolina and be just as successful without all of the international trappings of paperwork and so forth.
Part of your success was finding these holes in the market and then finding ways to exploit them. Are there any holes left to exploit in Florida? And what are the holes that you're looking at in Texas and Pennsylvania?
Well, Texas is one big hole. You know, there's only three operators, and all three of us are struggling to some degree. We're probably the strongest of the three at this point, with Parallel having its issues and then Texas Original having its issues. And so Texas represents a tremendous growth opportunity for us, and it's just one giant open market. The problem is that it's a grassroots build. We have to build those customers. And so just throwing dollars into Texas doesn't, you know, we've got to get that customer. We have the conditions. We have the medicine. We now have to get the customer informed. We've got to get them into their doctor. We've got to get them registered, and then we've got to get them as a customer product. That just takes time and energy, and sometimes money doesn't cure it. Money doesn't replace time in all instances. Pennsylvania, I would like to go vertical. Pennsylvania is a great cannabis market. It's a great cannabis culture, blue collar market with a high wage. You know, Pennsylvania people love cannabis, but we only have the three stores. that market does appear to be going towards an adult use. It looks like probably January 25. It looks like we'll get more stores that with that. We're ready for adult use there. I'd like to get vertical. I'd like to find a relationship with an operator, a cultivation operator. And we're going to be in Pennsylvania to stay, and we'll continue to build that market. I'd really like to look at Missouri. It's a red hot market right now, but it's one of those things that, you know, you got to get in, you got to get in now, or it's going to do the same thing for as far as competition and price compression as every other state. So I'd like to look at getting in there. And then again, looking at some operator that has a compatible footprint is where we are.
Any holes left to exploit in Florida?
Some. Florida's a big state. We're now focusing on the... So when I started, I told the real estate group, I said, our philosophy is going to be hit them where they ain't. And everywhere they're not is where we're going to be. And so we started finding those holes. We started developing a store locator model, which took a lot of effort. But now, after the last four stores, it's proved to be fairly accurate. And so... where you put a cannabis store, it doesn't utilize the blunt instruments of traffic and economics. You know, all of those blunt instruments that you would use to locate a Panera don't necessarily hold out for a cannabis store. And now we've understood the details of where to locate them. And so we're catching the edges of subpopulations. You take Orlando, you divide it into pieces of pie. We're only servicing three pieces of pie. There's a couple more that we haven't serviced. So, you know, as you know, in your commuting life, you're only going to move so far from your home and work. And so there's now we're working subpopulations of the larger urban areas is what we're looking at.
Without giving away, I guess, the secret sauce, what is the store locator equation, I guess, or process?
Well, you said without giving it away, give it away. I'll give you a couple points. One is you got to remember where these patients come from. They come from the doctors. And so where are the doctors? They went to that doctor because that doctor was closest to them typically. There's not really a competitive advantage on the medical providers at this point. They're all about the same price. What they do as a gatekeeper is not particularly unique from one another. You know, the doctors in this case, they look at the conditions, determine if you have a known condition, and then they match you into the registry, talk to you about drug safety. So their functionality is about the same. So it really comes into proximity. So if you can gather up where the doctors are, that's where the patients are. So that's one trick to it. The other thing is socioeconomics relate to your product line. So, you know, there's some areas that are more affluent. You're going to have a higher basket if you offer the product line in that area that brings the higher rate. So we've got a store that's in a lower socioeconomic area. It does fine, but it sells a lot of pre-rolls. It sells a lot of the lower bargain value flower. It sells a lot of the carts and it loves discounts. We've got a store over near Boca Raton. Those buyers come in there, you know, as they pull up in their Maseratis, they're pretty well set to buy whatever they need to buy. And they can buy a higher end concentrate. There's no limit to the, if you give them a high quality flower, they'll pay for it. And so matching your product profile to your socioeconomic indicators is important. Whereas if you're at Panera, you're going to sell the same sandwich and soup wherever you are. And so that's one of the adjustments that you'd have to make.
Do you have a prediction for potential federal legalization?
I think that legalization is a word that I think that is a little bit of a misnomer. I predict that it will be decriminalized, meaning it will be descheduled within the next 3 years. Biden floated that balloon up not too long ago. It was just a test balloon to see what the polls said. But the act of descheduling is, I think, first of all, the criteria of descheduling is a no-brainer. To be on Schedule 1 now, saying has no scientific, no medical purpose with the company that it's keeping is totally outlandish. The anecdotal evidence is in, the horse has left the barn. It's just now the political initiative to get it descheduled. Once it becomes descheduled, and then that allows for banking, the whole SAFE Banking initiative, which keeps getting killed, will be a little bit easier to deal with. We become legitimate from a banking source, a business source. Then from there, I think the best movement is to let it sit with the states. You know, you have 30-something states now with programs. They're already well-developed, robust programs. There's no need for a federal program. So if you legalize it, then you end up with some kind of interstate commerce regulation. Who takes it? The FDA, the DEA? You know, it really becomes a mess for us if the federal government starts trying to actually govern it and regulate it versus treat it more like insurance, where it's now the in the jurisdiction of the states. And then a state that's more conservative can elect not to have it. You know, that still the people of that state still get to choose the degree to which they want cannabis in their lives.
Have you had any issues with banking?
Oh, absolutely. We are still complete criminals when it comes to banking. You know, we don't accept or can't have access to the credit system. We don't have access to any of the federal systems. That includes the federal wire system, the federal ACH transfer issue. We're still moving cash. You know, we are just a very sophisticated looking criminal enterprise from a federal banking standpoint, and we're doing all of the, you know, measures and procedures as any other criminal enterprise, because that's how we're treated.
Do you have a personal a personal relationship to the industry at all?
Meaning
like, are you a recreational user? Do you have anyone in your family that, you know, has had a medical benefit as a result of it? Anything like that, a personal connection?
So, you know, the kind of one of the, you know, one-liners I tell when I talk about my history is, as I was involved in this legislative development and I was involved in these applications and the early challenges, and I had never touched this stuff. And so I was not a cannabis user up until about 3 years ago, when I personally discovered that it really helps me sleep. I'm not a smoker, so I don't use any of the inhalants, but the edibles and the other digestives have really caught my attention as far as a sleep aid, as far as an aid in getting my personal rhythms in line. You know, just nice, good sleep that you wake up crisp and clear allows you to you know, be successful in your day. The ability to sleep better and not stay awake at night because of anxiety has really been tremendous. And quite frankly, I've stopped drinking. You know, I guess we all have a drug of reliance, and mine was alcohol. And then when I went on to cannabis just for sleep, I stopped drinking during the day with alcohol and the run to the 5 o'clock martini. So that's my personal story. But I do have some friends and family that have benefited. And I tell you, the one benefit that I have seen that is dramatic is in PTSD. Mm-hmm. I have friends who had, you know, through their service experience, had tremendous PTSD. IEDs cause PTSD triggers related to like garbage cans, which immobilizes the person from being able to drive. And so using cannabis softens that result, softens that trigger point. And it works. It actually works. And so watching them find something that helps them get back into society and back to becoming a functional member has been very rewarding. And, you know, I was asked once before about my take on recreational. Looking back over my lifetime of experience with cannabis and those who used it in my life, I now can recognize, like, my roommate in college used it every day to study, to focus, to study. What I realized is that even recreational users are, to a huge amount of them, percentage-wise, are actually still using it medically. They're just self-diagnosing. They're self-treating. They're using it as palliative care when they may not have a formal diagnosis. They may not, their anxiety may not be so great to become a disorder, but it's great enough to impact them and their life, and cannabis helps. And now I look back as a non-cannabis user and look at those, you know, dope smokers that I grew up with and realize, well, a lot of them actually found the benefit early and they just didn't really know how to support it with science or medicine. But like I said, my roommate, he would smoke every day to go study. He would smoke and then study and did very well. Clearly, he was treating some kind of ADHD or some kind of attention issue where the cannabis helped him focus. It's a shame that the prohibition of this drug as medicine has not allowed those people to understand how they were treating themselves early on, that there wasn't science to support it, and that it wasn't accepted as having the benefits that it did in a much earlier state than we are in now. But it's here now. Anecdotal evidence is piling up. It's due to be descheduled. It can't support Schedule One at this point. I think that more and more people will come to it. My last step on that question is my father is a sworn non-drinker, non-smoker, non-anything person. Recently, about 3 weeks ago, has an issue with a pinched nerve or something in his back, and finally convinced him to try it. And he said for the first time in weeks, he's been able to sleep for enough time to feel rest because he's terribly afraid of opioids. They give him the prescription, he throws it away because he doesn't want to get hooked. He's terrified of getting hooked on opioids because, you know, he turns on Dateline and whatever and sees the situation we have in this country. He's found cannabis to be effective. I'm pretty happy to see him open up his mind and thoughts on the medicine itself. You know, it took him till 74 to get there, but he got there.
I mean, it must have been incredible to see the evolution of the social stigma over the course of your life.
It has been. And I was part of that. I mean, you know, I didn't partake. I didn't approve. It was not how I was raised, so to speak. And, you know, it just wasn't a thing that I did. And somehow I reconciled alcohol being an acceptable drug and cannabis not. You know, my own evolution has kind of followed that of society. And people ask me, like, when are we going to get adult use in this state? When are we going to get smokable flower? And I say, slow down. It's a cultural shift that has to occur. And here's how it happens in every state. Those who are against it, those who see it as the province of drug users or dope smokers or whatever, what has to happen is someone who's legitimate in their life has to find benefit from it. Their Aunt Betty has to start using the cream for her neuropathy on her feet. And all of a sudden they're getting, well, Aunt Betty's singing the praises of this. She's no dope smoker. She doesn't even have a tattoo or a gauge earring. She goes to church. There must be something to it. And then there's that personal connectivity where someone who's reliable, who's trustworthy, who's of good standing, if you would, gets that benefit. And it changes the mentality of these people, the perception. That has to happen. And that is a slow, amorphous type, organic type growth within a culture. And it happens everywhere I see. I mean, everywhere I go, I see that. And then the next thing that has to happen is on the negative side, you open a dispensary. It has to look like a legitimate business enterprise. And then it can't have what it doesn't have, what everyone expected, the line of druggies out front laying in the street, which have used this gateway drug to then ruin their lives. When that doesn't happen and Aunt Betty comes to it, then the state moves forward and the people move forward. And listen, we've had a little old lady bring a note from her pastor to say that she was okay if she took some cannabis because she had some neurological issues. Even the church can accept it if they realize it's for the benefit of their people and it doesn't have the negative connotations that were preached about for so many years.
Robert, I really appreciate you taking the time today and sharing your insight with the Cannabis Equipment News listeners and viewers. Before we get out of here, you know, is there anything else that you want to make sure the CEN audience knows either about yourself or Fluent?
Well, I want them to, you know, watch Fluent, buy stock. We're severely undervalued. I have no idea why we're where we are. I think it has to do with the politics and not. I think that we'd like more supporters and we'd like you to try our products. I think we have a lot of good offerings in Florida. Unfortunately, you need to be a patient to do so. But we could use the support and we could use the customer.
Excellent. Well, Robert, thanks again for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. Before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use, even just a simple thumbs up on YouTube. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach me at david@cannabisequipmentnews.com. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter and make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. For Robert Beasley, CEO of Fluent, I'm David Manti. This is the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast. We'll see you next week. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast.